Well, this is I don't know, the sixth or seventh in the series of stops that we've done. Hopefully, educating patients and also very importantly, public defenders. Because if any of you have had a public defender, unfortunately, they just don't get enough of these cases to be able to kind of stay up to speed in the law. And we're trying to educate them so that you guys can get better represented if it does come to that. What I'm going to do is talk for about a half hour or so on medical marijuana law. I'm going to start first by just giving a little brief history of marijuana prohibition in the United States generally, and then conclude with a little bit about the federal tax on medical marijuana in California and let you know where that is currently in the courts. And in between, sandwiched in the middle is the part that you're probably here to listen to, which is the actual status of the law in California, which is extremely complicated in no small part because probably 5 or 10 of you in this room were original authors of Prop 215. I'm sure if you weren't, you've probably each met someone or several people who claim to be. And for that reason and others, it isn't as clear as it might otherwise have been. And SB 420, which was the legislature's shot at it, that just came out several months ago, is even far less clear. So it seems like I'd rather have 200 medical marijuana patients writing the law as opposed to whatever it is, 50 legislators. But I'll try to unravel it for you in a way that makes sense. We're going to take questions at the very end, but if you have a very brief question as I'm going over something, especially where I'm talking about SB 420, feel free to raise your hand. So the first question is, does anyone know the first state to criminalize marijuana, or at least to pass restrictions?
I'm sorry. I just want to mention one more thing before you get going. As you can see, this session is being recorded. And if you want to say something and not have it recorded, you can just ask them to turn it off. Or you can wait until the end, and we'll turn it off at some point and then have any discussion to follow that.
Oh, and there's another tape recorder that's coming also.
Okay.
I'll shut it off if need be, but...
Sorry.
Yeah, nothing I actually say to you is any secret from anyone else. Oddly enough, though, actually, the public defender trainings we do are closed to prosecutors because I do say some things in there that I wouldn't want prosecutors to know about. They'll eventually learn about it, but in terms of some of our secrets and how to explain quantities and that sort of thing is something I don't want them to know yet. So the question is, what was the first state to criminalize marijuana? Does anyone know? Anyone want to take a crack at it?
New York.
Good guess. You can just shout out.
One of the tobacco states.
Like Virginia, which
something
is where I'm
like
from.
One of the states that produces tobacco.
Well, the answer is Utah. And I was actually stunned. One of the public defenders today got that right. 1915. The great state of Utah criminalized marijuana. The conventional wisdom is it was done as an anti-immigrant measure. Jobs were starting to dry up around that time. There were a substantial amount of Mexican immigrants in Utah, as I learned today, because the Mormons actually were quite tolerant at just before that to Mexican immigrants. And the idea was if you could make life miserable enough for people, they might move back to Mexico, in which case it would free up jobs for Americans. By 1917, every Western state and several other states had laws, including California, either restricting or forbidding marijuana. It was in 1937, by that point, every state had laws regarding marijuana. And more importantly, 1937 is when the feds got involved. It was in 1937 that the feds passed the Marijuana Tax Act. The brainchild behind it, the motivating force, was a gentleman by the name of Harry J. Anslinger. And I don't know how many of you have ever seen the documentary Grass.
Yes.
Okay, so you know he's a bad guy. And one of his famous quotes from the hearings before Congress was, quote, "Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death." And looking around the room, I think it's clear that we all agree with that, that statement. It very much resembles what marijuana had been portrayed in the popular media around that time. I don't know how many of you have seen Reefer Madness, but you know the image of a guy smoking pot and then he rapes and murders actually two different people. But clearly that is the effect that marijuana has on its users, according to Mr. Anslinger.
That's why I smoke.
There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Woodward, who was a high-ranking member of the American Medical Association, who also testified before that same Congress, and he criticized this statement for having absolutely no empirical or scientific support. Of course, marijuana doesn't cause insanity, criminality, or death. He was criticized by Congress for having an agenda, and they passed the Marijuana Tax Act without much more discussion than that. Very few accounts in the popular media. No one really knew what was going on. In fact, no one at the time even knew what marijuana was. It was actually up to that point in time called hemp, and it was called the Marijuana Tax Act in no small part because by calling it marijuana, people wouldn't know what they were talking about, and it would make it even easier to criminalize it because if you want to criminalize blibbly bloop, no one's really going to oppose you, and so that's how it got started. It wasn't until the late 1960s that was there any serious public discussion about marijuana. At that time, I think a lot of people, I'm sure some of you lived through it and were optimistic that marijuana would soon become legal. Unfortunately, in 1970, the Controlled Substances Act passed, and to justify the increasingly draconian sentences that were being meted out under the Controlled Substances Act, Nixon convened his National Commission on Marijuana Abuse. Unfortunately for Nixon, in 1971, that commission concluded that marijuana is innocuous, and it actually recommended its decriminalization for personal use. Nixon basically said overnight, my dead body. He ignored the findings, and the drug war was on, or at least the war against marijuana was on, which is when medical marijuana proponents turned elsewhere. In 1972, the first petition was filed with the DEA seeking to reclassify marijuana from a Schedule I substance to some other substance. The way it works is that for controlled substances, there's five schedules. Only Schedule I means that the substance has, quote, no currently accepted medical use. So Normal and several other petitioners petition the DEA saying it has medical use, and on top of that, it's not nearly as abusive as Schedule II substances like amphetamines and opiates, which are actually Schedule II substances, which means, according to the DEA, marijuana has a greater abuse potential than amphetamines or opiates, and in addition, has absolutely no currently accepted medical use. The DEA's response to the petition was simply to say the petition doesn't exist. There's no actual formal mechanism. We don't even have to look at your petition. The courts then took a look at that and said, no, you have to have some measure for the public to become involved in this, and they forced the DEA to take a look at it. So please come in and have a seat where you want. So what the DEA did was it simply sat on it for a couple years and then rejected the petition without holding any hearings or making any real findings. Same thing happens several years later until 1982, a petition was filed. DEA sits on it, rejects it, no hearing. Court says you can't do that. And at that point, the DEA decides to hold hearings. And is anyone aware of the name Francis L. Young? Does the name Francis L. Young mean anything? Someone who's unfortunately, I think, left out of the movie Brass, which shows a lack of its documentary efforts. But
safest, most
effective answer. That's exactly. You could probably almost quote the next one I'm about to read for you. It's for us. But Francis Young is a DEA administrative law judge who actually held these hearings. And from 1986 to 1988, he listened to the testimony of hundreds of patients, doctors, DEA agents, and others. Create a record. I mean, just the transcripts of the thing extend over 5 feet tall. And for anyone who does any administrative law, the administrative law is typically considered a kangaroo court. It's one of their boys. I mean, as an administrative law judge for the DEA, he was probably a former DEA agent. He certainly has worked with them his whole career, and you could expect what answer was coming. But quite the opposite happened. At the end of these 2 years, DEA law judge Young was convinced. And he was convinced in no uncertain terms. He issued a 100-page findings and recommendation in which he concluded, and I quote, the evidence in this record clearly shows that marijuana has been accepted as capable of relieving the distress of great numbers of very ill people and doing so with safety under medical supervision. It would be unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious for DEA to continue to stand between those sufferers and the benefits of this substance in light of the evidence in this record. Now, this was a shock to the DEA, but fortunately for it, it's all powerful. So what does the DEA do? The DEA simply criticizes Judge Young for applying the wrong legal standard. What it says is the legal standard is no currently accepted medical use. And the testimony of a bunch of patients and doctors doesn't count as a controlled scientific experiment amounting to currently accepted medical use. But since the DEA doesn't allow scientific studies to be performed, it's always going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. No matter what evidence they're presented, there will be no currently accepted medical use. So what happens is proponents of medical marijuana then turn elsewhere. I'm sorry, just to finish that story, in 1992, after sitting on these conclusions for 4 years, the DEA simply rejects the findings and recommendation, which prompts proponents of medical marijuana in 1996 to pursue Prop 215, and then with 56% of the California electorate voting in favor of it, it passed. And since then, there have been several federal attacks on Prop 215, which, if I have a moment at the end, I'll just tell you about the status of that. But more importantly, you guys probably want to know more about what the law is so that you guys can be most informed to protect yourself and to do things to comply with the law in the best way possible. Prop 215 is rather simple. Unfortunately, it's also somewhat flawed. It's simple in the sense that really all it does is it protects qualified patients and their designated primary caregivers from prosecution for possession or cultivation of marijuana. Now, to be a qualified patient is actually quite a low standard. It's even a lower standard than most people in the public even realize. Any illness qualifies as long as a doctor recommends marijuana to treat that illness. The doctor's recommendation doesn't actually have to be that card or any kind of formal written recommendation. It can be as simple as the doctor approves it. So if you go to the doctor, for instance, and you say, hey doc, I got migraines, do you think marijuana might help? And the doctor says, yeah, it might help, go ahead. That's good enough. And there's actually a specific case where that exact fact pattern occurred. The judge kicked out the defense and was reversed on appeal, with the Court of Appeals saying it's up to a jury to decide whether that is sufficient to qualify as, quote, an oral or written recommendation or approval.
I had heard that there's a thing called tacit approval, which is even more than what you're saying. If you tell the doctor you're using it and he doesn't say anything, he just, you know, doesn't say no, is that still in effect?
I don't know. I mean, there's no case that's actually, it's a good question, there's no case that's actually decided that issue. I actually would be inclined to think it's probably not the case based on the language the court used in that. The case is called People versus Jones, which is the migraine case.
It was during a time when it was very treacherous for doctors to do anything positive.
Right.
So this was a fallback.
I see. I mean, it's always worth using as a defense, but I actually don't think so. I mean, the idea of an approval tends to suggest something positive. Might help, go ahead, is good enough. I don't think anything, even nodding your head, might be good enough. I should mention, though, in that case, the doctor denied this conversation ever occurred.
Right.
It was simply a matter of defendant's word against the doctor's, and then it's up to the jury to decide.
Right.
So something to keep in mind. The flaw, however, there are three basic flaws of Prop 215. The first basic flaw is it only covers cultivation and possession. Doesn't cover transportation, doesn't cover sales, doesn't cover even maintaining a house or premises where marijuana is cultivated. So you've got some necessary criminal laws. SB 420 took care of that, and took care of that quite simply. They simply added those criminal offenses to the offenses that you're exempted from if you qualify as a patient and primary caregiver. Another flaw, as you well know, is there's no formal distribution system, and arguably there's no legal distribution system. What people think counts, and this is what gets the most people into trouble, and I urge you, if the cops ever come, what I strongly recommend is you show them your doctor's recommendation, you tell them it's all medical, do not say anything about primary caregivers or being a primary caregiver or anything like that. Do not say the marijuana is for anyone else. The trouble is that people think they can talk their way out of it. They think, oh, what I'm doing is legal. I'm growing for myself, let's say, and five other people. I have 100 plants. It's all for medical use. The problem is that the definition of a primary caregiver is not what the general public thinks it is. The definition of a primary caregiver is the person who has, quote, consistently assumed the responsibility for the housing, health, or safety of a qualified patient. It's not the housing, health, or safety that's the problem. Courts seemingly understand that providing marijuana is assuming responsibility for their health, as well as their safety, so they don't have to troll the streets looking for marijuana. The problem is the phrase consistently assumed. And in a case that involved Dennis Perrone and his cannabis dispensary, the court found that designating Dennis as the primary caregiver doesn't do the trick, because simply providing marijuana to a qualified patient does not make you their primary caregiver, is what the court found in that case. And their reasoning is because you can go buy your marijuana from anywhere else. You can shop around. You can go to five different dispensaries. That may be different in a situation where you're talking about a close circle of friends. And that's where SB 420 does make an improvement, although it doesn't redefine primary caregiver, which is why do not tell the cops you're a primary caregiver, and do not think that you're necessarily going to be entitled to a defense. But what SB 420 does do is it explicitly allows for cooperatives and collectives of patients and their primary caregivers to get together and cultivate marijuana in a cooperative or collective environment. So people then ask me, what's a cooperative or what's a collective? A cooperative is actually defined under California law. Beyond that, I can't tell you exactly what it is. I mean, the general principle is that basically it's kind of from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. It typically doesn't involve buying the actual marijuana each time you buy it, but will involve some expense up front. But that's somewhat of an elastic concept. A collective is simply not defined. So anything that's not a cooperative could be a collective. On the other hand, what a collective is also somewhat unclear. So I warn you that if you do involve yourself in any of this activity, you're always running the risk of a criminal prosecution. The law is not clear, and that's just something you should definitely be aware of. Although I realize Santa Cruz is much more generous than most other counties and has juries that will probably refuse to convict under any of these circumstances. SB 420 also did one other thing of importance, at least in terms of distribution. And what it did was it allows for a primary caregiver, if you actually are a qualified primary caregiver, to receive a reasonable reimbursement of costs. Prior to SB 420, the law was at most you could receive a bona fide reimbursement of expenses, which is basically the price of fertilizer in the seeds. So it's nothing. SB 420 allows you now to recoup, if you're a primary caregiver from a patient, you can recoup a reasonable reimbursement for your labor. So all of a sudden we're talking about you can actually pay a fair value for the marijuana, and that will also be protected so long as you're actually designated primary caregiver. SB 420 also did two other things, which is the source of the greatest confusion in this area. It established minimum threshold quantities, minimum quantities below which no locality could go below. The reason why this was important is that you have counties like Sonoma and Humboldt County, which have basically a 99 plant rule and a 100 square foot rule and a 3 pound rule, which is basically, as long as you have less than 99 plants, less than 100 square feet of cultivated marijuana, and less than 3 pounds, they wouldn't bundle.
For people that have the ID.
Well, this is a year or two ago. I mean, this is still currently the system. Well, I'm about to talk about that. In Sonoma County was similar, and then you have counties down, you have places like LA County, which, my understanding is, didn't have guidelines. You had other counties that had guidelines of 2 plants, but in places that didn't have counties, you had cops who basically felt like 1 plant was the limit and might even bust people. I was surprised doing this last week down in Riverside, there was a case of a qualified patient having less than an ounce of marijuana, and they're actually facing criminal charges.
And so they have hash?
No, this was straight, this was less than an ounce of...
Because they don't recognize any condensed THC in Southern Cal. If you have oil, if you have hash, any of that, that's all completely criminal.
And, which is unfortunate, I mean, which SB 420 doesn't fix that. Under the law itself, it should already be included, because the criminal penalties you're being excluded from include cannabis, concentrated cannabis. So that's why we're hoping to, that's why we're doing this, and that's why we're hoping we can change the minds of some judges maybe down in Southern California. But the legislature recognized you had these great disparities. I mean, people were not being allowed to use medical marijuana the same throughout the state. So SB 420 creates minimums, floors. And what those floors are 8 ounces of the manicured bud portion of marijuana. So if you're talking about, you know, it's drying out, it doesn't count the whole plant. What you're talking about is just 8 ounces of bud. And in addition to that, you're allowed to have 6 mature plants or 12 immature plants. If you're talking about combination, it gets murky, but usually, you know, you cultivate all at once anyway, so you're either gonna have 12 immature or 6 mature plants. I realize that probably isn't gonna do many of you any good, because in Santa Cruz, I'm guessing that the local authorities will tolerate quantities greater than that. But at least now, throughout the state of California, every qualified patient is allowed to possess that amount. SB 420 does one more thing, as Hillary mentioned, which are these voluntary ID cards.
Now, that isn't going to make them lower the limits in a town like Santa Cruz because of SB 420.
I hope not. There are three.
They've allowed me my garden at 10 plants before, prior to SB 420.
Well, my three concerns with SB 420 is that localities may reduce their guidelines down to what these minimal floors of SB 420. On the other hand, SB 420 specifically states that a locality can opt to have quantities above those numbers. So what happens is that if a locality, if Santa Cruz has, I don't know what the number is in Santa Cruz, but let's say it's 20. Actually, my understanding is Santa Cruz is in the process of devising numbers. But if Santa Cruz comes up with a number, let's say 20, then the way it actually works is that under SB 420, you're then protected up to 20 plants. So the idea is that LA can't go below the 6 plants and 8 ounces, but if Santa Cruz wants to have a higher floor, they can have a higher floor.
Multiple patients living on the same property at that point would be protected to 40, if 20 was the number?
Exactly, so each patient under SB 420 can possess what they say quantities consistent with this article. So if you have a cooperative or a collective environment, it's 8 ounces per person at any one time, plus 6 or 12 plants. Now, I should caution you that there may be some ambiguity in terms of whether these local guidelines, I mean, it explicitly says that you can opt out, the local locality can opt out. There may be some question about whether SB 420 gives you that many per patient. So in other words, I mean, there's a real question about in Humboldt, let's say, if you have 10 patients who have a farm, can they actually have 1,000 plants? Or at least 990. My answer would be yes. That would be the legal argument, but I don't want you to get in trouble doing it and thinking I told you it's all, you know, it's all legal. Although that is my view that it is
today.
The one other thing SB 420 does is that it establishes voluntary identification cards. And just by a show of hands, how many people have heard about these mythical SB 420 voluntary ID cards? Okay, so most of you. I'm not going to talk a lot about them, because they don't yet exist. At some point, they will be run by the local department, county of whatever it is, county of public health. Who knows when that will be? Some estimates are 3 or 4 months. Some estimates are a year from now. I think they're overrated, and the reason why they're overrated is that most of SB 420 applies regardless of whether you have the voluntary ID card. SB 420 is not just about the voluntary ID cards. These quantities do not apply only if you have the voluntary ID card. As it's currently written, these quantities apply either to a patient, qualified patient, or to a person with a voluntary ID card. So all the voluntary ID card it does is it provides you a get out of jail free card. What that means is that the way the current law, Prop 215, has been interpreted by the courts is that the Compassionate Use Act only provides you roughly an affirmative defense in court or a basis to dismiss the indictment before your trial. It does not deprive a police officer of probable cause to continue his search simply because you show him the doctor's recommendation. So you've got the current problem of the police get a tip. They smell marijuana at your residence. They come, they find 3 plants. You show them your doctor's recommendation. That the cops are, by law, allowed to continue to search your residence. They then are allowed to seize your property and basically let a DA decide whether to charge you. You can obviously see the problem with this. Too many patients around the state have gotten their medicine deprived by cops taking their property first and asking questions later, which is a large part of the reason why we're trying a campaign to encourage people to file motions for return of property. Because even if criminal charges are not brought, you're entitled to get your property back. And if the property has been damaged or spoliates because they leave it and it dries out, you're entitled to get damages. And
that's in the language of the law right now?
No.
Okay.
It's putting together a bunch of cases. And putting together those cases, it actually involves cases where the cops take people's guns and they damage the guns, and the person files a motion for return of property, and then you're entitled to the gun back. And in addition, the court says, well, here's $500 because they damaged it to the tune of $500. So it's certainly my legal view that this is the case. We are encouraging patients to do this, and soon on our website we'll have a form that you can essentially do it yourself and file these motions for return of property and hopefully get damages to compensate you, because it certainly warms my heart when the police are forced to pay people for marijuana that they've taken from them. Mm-hmm. And for a change to have the street values of marijuana that they always boast about in the media.
Yeah.
So-called, you know, $6,000 pounds of marijuana when they pay for price. It will be a great pleasure to see them paying $6,000 for a pound of marijuana that they've taken from someone, you know, and destroyed.
I've also had two clients that I filed claims for on their homeowners policy and won, both up in Placer County, one in Sacramento County. And what's interesting is in the write-up of the insurance claim, they endorsed the fact that this was stolen by the sheriff's department, that the marijuana had been stolen.
I like
stolen
that.
Property.
Well, that's exactly
great.
Well,
used it in a civil case afterwards. You know, it's like
perfect. Taking something without legal authority, and it turns out there's one other thing involved in all this, which is it's what I call the silver bullet, which is called the Bain Civil Rights Act. And what the Bain Civil Rights Act does is it allows you to sue anyone, for that matter, for violating your constitutional or statutory rights. And because under Prop 215 it explicitly ensures everyone the right to use marijuana for medical use, there's the possibility of suing the police if they take your marijuana for violating your statutory right to use marijuana for medical use. I should say that it only applies where someone violates your statutory rights through force, intimidation, coercion, or violence. But I clearly think when a cop shows you his badge and takes it, that's clearly force, coercion, and arguably violence. The reason why it's so important is that it allows you to get triple damages. So if we're talking about a sizable quantity of marijuana, the cops may have to pay triple damages, and on top of that, you're entitled to attorney's fees. So that might entice some lawyers to actually get involved in doing these things. We currently have a case involving a woman named Sister Samaya down in LA, where we're suing the cops for having repeatedly gone to her house and taken her stuff. But the last time, we're talking about 5 pounds and 22 plants. So we're talking about in the neighborhood of $50,000 worth of marijuana. When you triple that, we're talking about $150,000 plus attorney's fees. So it'll certainly, again, that would warm my heart if the LAPD have to pay out, pay Sister Samaya $100,000
or $150,000. How do you spell that?
Bain, B-A-N-E, and then Civil Rights Act. It's California Civil Code sections 51.7 and 52.1 is where you can find it in the Civil Code. So the Volunteer ID card, what it does is it tries to remedy this to some extent. It doesn't explicitly apply to searches. However, we expect it will be taken that way, but at least it explicitly applies to arrests. Not only did they take Sister Samaya's property, but they also they arrested her and held her in jail. One time it was 40-something days before she was tried and ultimately acquitted. Then 6 months after that, they did the same thing to her. They held her in jail for 4 days before releasing her with no charges ever being filed. What the Voluntary ID card system does is it'll allow the cop to have a 24-hour hotline that he can call, verifying that you are a patient, and once it's verified, he must not arrest you. So at least protect you from the arrest. We're hoping it will protect people from searches and seizures, but if that doesn't work, hopefully motions for return of property will provide an economic incentive for the cops to stop harassing patients.
If you have that card and they don't call within 24, 48 hours, then do you then have grounds to go after them for keeping you in jail for this extra time? Doesn't that protect your rights?
Yeah, they're actually not supposed to. In other words, they will call. It originally would be a 24-hour hotline. I think it's envisioned to then extend to be an internet service they can look up, but they will they will check it and they will not arrest you if that's the case. And
that's really good.
I would certainly be interested in it if it ever, if anyone is actually arrested anyway, we would certainly be interested in a civil suit.
It's written in the law that there's consequences to the law enforcement officer if they don't do this, but it doesn't specify what those are.
And also, the police told me that if the same person that you suspect that turned you in for pot once, if they turn you in another time, you can then sue them for false arrest. And I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly what he told me, but they can't do it again. They're not allowed to do it. They can turn you in again, but then you can like sue them.
If that's the case, it's county policy. But as we unfortunately learned in Sister Samaya's case, where they busted her five separate times, they arrested her twice. No charges were filed in three of the five. But she actually, it was the third search and seizure where they actually arrested her, held her in jail, and she was then acquitted. And what happened was 6 months later, same cop who had arrested her the last time around went into her backyard with five other cops without a warrant, which is completely illegal. Took all of her stuff and arrested her again. So we certainly are suing them for false arrest, in part based on the theory that that they knew darn well she was a medical marijuana patient, and a legitimate one at that, at least in the eyes of the jury. We'll see how it plays out, but I wouldn't.
This is a policeman actually talking about the person who turned me in, to do it again. I couldn't do anything.
Right.
Because I had told that person that I had it, they'd seen my documentation, and they turned me in anyway. And they said, they do it again, you can.
Perhaps, but I mean, I guess that all will remain to be seen. And hopefully we'll make some good law in Sister Samaya's case. And that way, you know, if it does happen, that would be the case. But before I conclude, I just want to talk briefly, and I think we'll have time for questions later if you have more questions about medical marijuana law in California. But I just want to talk briefly about the interplay between the federal government and the state, because this is far more misunderstood, especially by public defenders than I would have imagined, and even by patients. And it first involves when Prop 215 was originally passed, the White House administration, at that time it was the Clinton administration, actually issued an official administration response. And in that official administration response, the White House demanded, quote, all evaluations of the medical usefulness of any controlled substance must be conducted through the congressionally established research and approval process managed by the National Institute of Health and the Food and Drug Administration. In other words, the federal government wanted to maintain the stronghold that they had on the scientific process. There can be no currently accepted medical use if you don't allow anyone to conduct experiments. They didn't want the state of California or the state of Arizona, for that matter, conducting controlled scientific experiments. So they demand that this all be done through their own regulatory agencies. They were remarkably honest about why they were doing this. In a later section of their administrative response called Public Education, the government actually claims that it will continue to educate Arizonans and Californians about, quote, the real and proven dangers of smoking marijuana, unquote, through a, quote, message that will remind the public there is no medical use for smoked marijuana. So they were actually going to keep control of the scientific process and then educate children in public schools that their parents were essentially off their rockers when they voted to approve these initiatives in California and Arizona. Unfortunately for the government, its own National Institute of Medicine, which is the body it convened to conduct the scientific studies, in 1999 concluded that marijuana does in fact have medical use, and it recommended that it be decriminalized for medical use. Needless to say, the federal government once again ignored those recommendations, and instead it went on a multi-part strategy to try to shut down medical marijuana in the state of California. Its first strategy was to target doctors. The idea is that under Prop 215, it's not simply legal to use marijuana for medical use. It's legal to use marijuana for medical use on the advice of a physician. So if you take the physician out of it, there can never be legal medical marijuana use. And they try to take the physician out of it by threatening the revocation of the licenses of physicians that recommended marijuana to their patients. What happened was a group of patients, doctors, and the ACLU filed suit and won. And the Court of Appeals found that this was a violation of the First Amendment rights of patients and doctors, and enjoined the federal government from doing this. This caused the government to go to Plan B. Plan B was to try to shut down the cannabis clubs. And so they filed a civil suit against six of the cannabis clubs throughout the state, and they won, but only kind of. What happened was is those six cannabis clubs are no longer operating, and in their stead, 25 or 30 new ones popped up. So the federal government realized that was futile, so they went to the most punitive possible means they could think of. What they figured was is they would prosecute people who cultivated for the cannabis clubs. They would use the extremely draconian penalties under federal law. They would deprive the people who were cultivating of any defense in federal court. They would convict them, they would sentence them, or have them sentenced to 10 years in prison. And this would deter people from continuing to cultivate for patients in the state of California. The first gentleman who was attacked was a gentleman by the name of Brian Eppes. The federal government filed what's called a motion in limine to exclude any mention of medical marijuana in his case, and they were successful. The reasoning is he was charged with cultivation of marijuana, conspiracy to cultivate marijuana, and maintaining a place where marijuana was cultivated. And under federal law, the reasons for doing this are irrelevant. The question is simply, did you cultivate marijuana? The answer is yes. So Brian Eppes went to federal court without a defense. Understandably, he was convicted. He then faced a statutory minimum sentence of 10 years. And the judge gave him that minimum sentence of 10 years. There is no such thing as parole in the federal system, which means that 10 years actually means 10 years. There is a 15% reduction that you can get for a good time served, but that's it. So for Mr. Eppes, he will be incarcerated in one form or another for 8.5 years of his life. He is currently in federal prison. The next person on their list was Keith Alden. Again, same story, Keith Alden was convicted. Fortunately for Keith Alden, he met the qualifications for the safety valve. He was sentenced, I say fortunately, but only based on what had happened before, to 44 months in federal prison. He was recently released on bail pending appeal after serving approximately a year for reasons I'll get into briefly in just a moment. If he loses that case, he will be back in prison serving the remainder of his sentence. Steve McWilliams pled guilty and got a 10-year sentence, and things looked dire until the case of Ed Rosenthal. I assume most of you have heard of Ed Rosenthal, and what happened at the end of that was the judge found that he qualified for the safety valve and gave him a one-day time served sentence, and since then things have begun to look up. Mike Foley was recently sentenced to 6 months of home detention. Judy Lynn Osborne was sentenced to probation. He was sentenced to a year in prison, but that was because he had a gun, which is certainly unfortunate, but better than the 10 years meted out to Brian Eppes. And the other positive thing that's been happening in the federal courts is what's been happening under the Commerce Clause. And what it is that the federal government may be supreme under our Constitution, but it's limited, or at least it's supposed to be limited. And the federal government's supreme in the areas in which it's entitled to regulate, but it is only allowed to regulate in the areas specifically enumerated in the Constitution, the power to convene an army, the power to tax, and the one that they have used to do everything under the sun is the power to regulate commerce among the several states. Now, we all know that in the last 8 years, I mean, for people looking at this thing, this has been going on now in the state of California for 8 years. There is no evidence, there's absolutely no empirical evidence that marijuana is leaking out from California to other states. It has had absolutely no effect on interstate commerce. Despite this complete lack of empirical evidence, the federal government continues to claim the power to regulate this under the Interstate Commerce Clause. And on December 16th of this past year, in a case called Raich versus Ashcroft, which is the biggest case to date, I would say in drug history, but certainly in medical marijuana history, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which is basically the entire West Coast, it's the largest Court of Appeals, it's below only the United States Supreme Court, held that it was beyond the federal government's powers under the Interstate Commerce Clause to regulate marijuana cultivated for personal medical use. So what most people don't know, but it's not just legal under California law, but it is either legal under federal law, or at least it is unconstitutional for the federal government to harass or in any way regulate patients who cultivate marijuana for their personal medical use. And just about approximately 3 weeks ago, this decision was extended to in the context of the WAM case. It was extended to a cooperative that distributes, at least according to the model provided in WAM. And someday I certainly hope to see this extended to dispensaries that are actually selling it to patients so that patients can have the greatest access to marijuana under both state and federal law. And that's where the law is. And at that point, I'll turn it back over to Hillary and field any questions.
What's the safety valve you mentioned? I'm sorry.
The safety valve is simply that there are these mandatory minimums under federal law. 100 to 1,000 plants, 5-year mandatory minimum. 1,000 or more plants, it's a 10-year mandatory minimum. They double essentially if you have one prior felony drug conviction. They triple. You're actually looking at life in prison if you're without the possibility of parole if you're talking about two priors. However, if you have there are five criteria. If you have no criminal history, if you're not a leader, supervisor, organizer, or manager, if you didn't use a gun in the commission of the offense, and two others, which I'm currently forgetting now, you would qualify for the safety valve, which then allows the judge to come down into the what's called the sentencing guideline range, which is more along the lines of 44 months. And if there's reasons for a further downward departure, which is what Judge Breyer did in the Rosenthal case, where he actually, I think he cited three downward departures and awarded 12 points of downward departures, which is a substantial amount, and that's what allowed him to get to the range that allowed him to give a one-day time serve sentence. But if you have a criminal history, if you've ever had a drug offense, if you had a gun involved in the case, if you're a supervisor, leader, organizer, or manager, you're not eligible, and then you're talking about a 5-year sentence, or a 10-year sentence, or a 20-year sentence, or possibly a life sentence.
Did you mention, when I stepped out, Keith Alden's release upon appeal and the federal judge's ruling that he doesn't have to be drug tested because he's legally protected?
No. Thanks for reminding me. Some more good news. I mean, it's been good news after good news. It seems like ever since the Rosenthal case, or the sentencing rather than the Rosenthal case, the judge screwed. I mean, you probably heard Ed Rosenthal's comment about the judge did me no favors. I don't want you to leave the room thinking Judge Breyer's any hero either. Judge Breyer committed numerous reversible errors in order to get Ed convicted. He should never have deprived the jury of the unique defense that was involved in that case. And I fully expect that he will be reversed on appeal at some point.
And he's the one who found against us in the OCBC.
Oh, yes, yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, he's the one who first said it was Commerce Clause. We fought that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's wrong. I expect him, I hope he's reversed other times. But in any case, though, he did do us the favor of the one-day time served sentence. And since then, we've seen victory after victory in various contexts in the courts. One of them involved Keith Alden, where the panel of the Ninth Circuit that he's before let him out of prison on bail pending appeal, citing the Commerce Clause issue. And that's why we're hopeful, perhaps in his case, perhaps in OCBC case, perhaps Ed's case, we'll see that these Commerce Clause decisions are extended to protect even the quid pro quo, or the direct exchange of money for marijuana. The next part about this that was all nice, and this was just a couple weeks ago, was that after Keith Alden was released on bail pending appeal, the magistrate who was deciding the terms of his bail conditions based on this earlier Rage decision crossed out or struck the clause of his bail condition that forbade him from using marijuana while he's on bail. So currently, Keith Alden is allowed to smoke marijuana for medical use legally while he's released on bail pending appeal. There's going to be a question in one of these cases about whether you can use marijuana, whether you can cultivate marijuana for your personal medical use while you're on bail, even in these federal cases. And the case law is very clear now in California that if you're on probation, that it is improper for the court to use as a probation condition a restriction on your use of marijuana so long as you have a legitimate medical recommendation. So obviously, I mean, this is a very different world we live in than one even 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and certainly very different than it was 10 years ago.